The Arctic is quickly becoming a policy focus. I mean, really quickly. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. It's not just the controversy over drilling plans for the Beaufort and Chukchi and ESA. As we'll hear, the results from the International Polar Year are not even fully analyzed yet, but nations are beefing up their Arctic presences. Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Alaska is the only Arctic state, and that's why we're talking about it again on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, it's going to be kind of an action-packed show today with very much of a moving target, and thank you for being with us. First in line here, we will talk about the new report, which actually comes out here in about an hour, and it is coming from the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. It's entitled Climate Change and International Security, the Arctic as a Bellwether. The American Geophysical Union is meeting on Arctic issues in Washington, D.C. today, and this study from C2ES is going to be presented to them shortly. And we have one of the authors of the report. I would say probably not the main author, but the senior scientist at the center, who's Jay Gulledge, joins us by cell phone from Washington, D.C. Jay, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, thanks very much for inviting me.
Well, we do understand that basically Rob Hubert, the political scientist and very much a strategic studies kind of person, is responsible for a lot of the research in this huge overview of the Arctic, but he's very busy at the AGU right now, so I'm very glad you could come and join us and help walk us through this a little bit.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to do that.
Well, all right. So first off, your organization. Now, some people might think that the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions is an environmental group, but that is not my perception of it.
Well, we're really more of a business-oriented group. We used to be called the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, and we, from our founding in 1998, we've had a Business Environmental Leadership Council that today has a membership of 40-odd, mostly Fortune 500 companies, and our main goal is to figure out how we're going to solve the problem of climate change and energy security in a way that's economically viable, and that's why we work with companies to find those solutions.
And what you found out, essentially, is that everybody is positioning around the Arctic. I mean, things are very much in motion in just the last 4 or 5 years, wouldn't you say, in general?
It really all started when Russia planted its flag at the North Pole in 2007 in August. That got a lot of press around the world. Maybe less well known is that the same week, Canada announced major new military Arctic military investments, they want to protect their territorial waters around the Canadian archipelago, where the Northwest Passage is opening up every year since 2007 now. And so the retreat of the ice in the Arctic and the opening of the water is driving a lot of attention to the region from mainly the Arctic states, but others as well. And since 2007, you've had really major policy announcements on the Arctic from Canada, Denmark, Norway, Russia, the United States, the Nordic countries, NATO. I mean, it goes on and on, as you said, and it all started after 2007, so it's been very, very recent.
Well, I think it raises a lot of eyebrows when they find out that China's got a big icebreaker coming.
Yes, China. Now, they haven't expressed any strategic interest in the Arctic. They haven't openly done that, but they are gearing up to do more scientific research in the Arctic. They are a very energy-hungry country. It seems obvious that they would be interested in energy from an energy security perspective and the fossil fuel resources, also the transportation between Europe and Asia. So they're not going to be left on the sidelines as the Arctic opens up.
I like the way that the report puts down three hypotheses, one of which is that things will stay pretty much the same for a while. Two, that everybody will make nice and do everything through the diplomatic channels like they did with Antarctica. And hypothesis three, which is that it's getting more and more military and it's happening very fast. And basically then in the analysis, it becomes very clear that hypothesis three, it's someplace between hypothesis two of the diplomatic solution and hypothesis three, beefing up militarily as quickly as possible, where reality lies at the moment, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. So those three hypotheses come directly out of the Arctic Council's Arctic shipping assessment from 2009. They posed those scenarios. We thought, you know, these read just like hypotheses. If you wanted to interpret the emerging security environment in the Arctic, you could use these to sort of cipher what's developing up there, and that's what we did here. And as you said, it turns out that for the moment, the prevailing conditions in terms of the announcements that the countries have made and the actions they've taken are very cooperative. Hypothesis two, that there will be good cooperation as the Arctic opens up, that really is the prevalent theme right now, and that's encouraging. However, what's going on in a layer below that is that almost all of the Arctic countries are building modern military capabilities to operate in the Arctic that go far beyond just being able to police their local waters. And so that raises the question, if, you know, they're just beginning to talk about extending their continental shelf so that they know their national territories where they will have economic rights to explore for resources, that process is going to take years. And if they get into entrenched disagreements that prove difficult to solve through diplomatic means, they're going to have Arctic capabilities. They're going to have real combat capabilities up there. They're going to have the ability to try to intimidate each other. And so the question right now stands, which way will it tip? Will it stay collegial, or will it tip toward hypothesis three and become more of an adversarial environment?
Well, now we see very different politics in each of the Arctic nations, really. And I think probably for a lot of us in Alaska who watch Arctic issues, we get a little impatient with the U.S. government. But the fact of the matter is that while Congress may be a bit stalled on even such a simple thing as ratifying the Law of the Sea Treaty, and certainly not really looking at what the Coast Guard is going to need to have a realistic presence in the Arctic, let alone the Navy, we are seeing the Obama administration, the State Department, loosen up a bit. I mean, the previous administration wouldn't really participate in the Arctic Council much, and we saw the Secretary Clinton actually went to a meeting.
So you're really on top of this, and that's a new development. And the U.S. basically just hasn't believed in the past that the Arctic was strategically important to the country. And you know that changes when the Secretary of State herself shows up at the Arctic Council meetings. And that has happened now. And the Obama administration has also send pretty strong signals that it's going to go ahead and build another icebreaker. I don't think that's actually the funding hasn't been set aside for that, but it's been made a policy priority now. And so those things are changing, but it is true. The United States is far behind all the other Arctic countries, with the exception of Iceland, which has no military, in terms of its ability to operate in the Arctic. We can go under the ice with our subs, with our submarines. We don't have any surface capabilities.
Well, Jay, I know you're going to have to leave us in a moment, and we may even run out of power in your cell phone, but let me see if I can quickly sketch in a little bit more. You look at the map, and maybe it makes you get a better idea of why it is that Canada is the most aggressive of the nations beefing up militarily in the Arctic, because they have a navigable waterway there that they really are going to need to patrol or whatever. And at this point, as I understand it, the United States even disputes that Northwest Passage is Canada's waters. They consider it similar to the Bering Straits, that it's an international strait.
Yeah, the U.S. position is that, yes, it is national waters, except for the purpose of international transit for navigation, in which case they consider it an international strait, freely navigable to all countries. That's the kind of dispute that we haven't needed to resolve that. That passage hasn't been open until recent years. But in the future, how are we going to resolve that? You know, the United States is not has not acceded to the Law of the Sea Treaty. And this is also important for extending our continental shelves. If there are disputes about transit, about the continental shelf dividing lines, it's not clear that the United States is going to be able to dispute the claims of other countries, Canada and Russia, about those issues. The U.S. military has supported accession to the Law of the Sea for many years, and Congress has not, for a variety of reasons, been willing to ratify it. But basically, we're getting down to where it's time. We've got to put really strong multilateral diplomatic tools in place to deal with these emerging militaries in the Arctic. And the Arctic Council has a ban on discussing military security issues. But it's the strongest and only full multilateral mechanism we have for dealing with the Arctic as a region. All of the Arctic countries are a member. It's a well-respected organization. And we, in our report, say that it's time for the Arctic Council to drop its ban so that they can talk about military issues.
Jay Gulledge, I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's Jay Gulledge giving us a kind of a wake-up call from the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. They today have released a report that calls attention to the way things are rapidly moving on the policy front when it comes to the Arctic. And that's our issue today on Talk of Alaska. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. And your calls are welcome right now. And I have a couple of other guests lined up that will appear probably later in the show. I originally wanted to do this about the science of the Arctic because it's very fascinating. We had the International Polar Year, which basically paid for a whole lot of field observations of the Arctic, and we've heard very little of what the results of it were. So I started asking around. And, you know, I found out, well, they're all in meetings yet. They're still analyzing it. They had a very interesting meeting just last week, well, just a few days ago, actually. They finished on Friday in Montreal of the scientists who did International Polar Year research. And it was clear at that meeting that the Canadian scientists were not really free to speak of what they had found. Well, that's kind of a startling development. You know, what are we to make of this? We can say that, you know, the Harper administration in Canada is in a problematical political situation right now, and then that might be behind it, that wouldn't help that administration really in its perilous condition to have loose talk from scientists that went against government policy, perhaps. But regardless, it just indicates that this dynamic that Jay was telling us about things hardening up in a strategic sense, even as we're trying to explore in a scientific sense, everything's moving really, really fast. Let's go to Roberta, who joins the program from Homer. Roberta, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning. And I wish some of your specialists was going to be on, because now I'm just going to be talking to myself and fellow Alaskans. But where the hell is the talk and concern about the environment? Ocean acidification, pollution, catastrophic spills, huge corporate power and money. And the title of the group is Climate Change. And there wasn't even one word spoken about the environment, and that is the huge elephant in the room that corporate America and international corporate doesn't even want to talk about. And I'm going to advise people or suggest that there is a documentary out right now that is called Thrive, and it is really an important work. And we can get things straightened out one by one. And this documentary really, really talks about all of these problems. And doesn't just put them under the rug where corporate America and greed and power and the governments does. So those are my comments.
Roberta, are you Occupy Homer today?
Well, I wish. I've been a little lazy on that, but that is where we need to be. And I'm telling you, this documentary, Thrive, is just phenomenal.
Well, if you could just tell me just a little bit more about it, because is this similar to the transition movement you probably have heard about, or permaculture people?
I don't know if they're together. This is a pretty much lone standing, but it was done by Foster Gamble from Procter & Gamble. And he has spent his life, they were grooming him to take over the corporation, and 30 or 40 years ago, he decided that was not where he wanted to go. Science was his interest, and he started doing research. And he's researched for this length of time worldwide, and he has some shocking information, and sometimes you're like, whoa, this is a little bit too woo-woo-wah-wah, but on the other hand, there is some facts and figures in this documentary that shakes your world and then makes us want to say, enough is enough. We've watched them attempt to, or doing very well at destroying not only our environment and this incredible earth we live on, but our economic base. We have watched people, our fellow people, do this and get slaps on the wrist for putting us in the economical disaster we're in right now. And it is fascinating, and it covers so many things. But one of the big ones is a whole new energy, a complete new idea of energy. And it's a little over my head. It's very scientific. And it is really about what most of us have been being told since we were little, that the oil companies have been keeping information from the public any way they can so that they can continue to have their money in spite of the facts are out about the damage that is being done. And so it is amazing, and it does come up with solutions, and luckily living in Homer allows us to be a part of the solution, and one of them is sustainable living, and just goes on to say how we've ended up. I've been asking, how could we have let the food, just talking about the food, from when I grew up in the 1960s, 50s, 60s, where we actually had real food to eat, and where we are now when you go into a grocery store, and it explains why the chemical companies and the oil companies, and it just makes sense, took that whole thing over, and that's why we are eating stuff that will kill us now that is being said that it's food. And so there's solutions, but it's not going to be that we get to just sit back and continue our convenient lifestyle in the United States. We're part of the problem, and we're part of the solution, and very capable of being part of the solution.
Roberta, I want to thank you very much. I think this is, maybe some people there's a dawning of common sense, and it's
That's
more a matter
what
of
this one's all about. It yeah. is. It's really great, and I just want to ask.
But I will say, in defense of Jay Gulledge and the people over at Pew, that they are deliberately choosing to try and engage the business community into a more long-term and sustainable-looking way of looking at the environment, and it is because they feel that some of the practices of short-term capitalism are contrary to a sustainable environment. I mean, that's
and
why they're doing
it. The word thrive. I mean, really, that's what this is all about.
All right.
We can thrive. And worldwide. It's not just a little, tiny spot in the world. It's talking worldwide. And it is a new energy solution, which really isn't that new. It was developed in 1901.
All right.
Squelched.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
It's reminding me of that guy that talked about the pill you could put in your gas tank along with water.
There you go.
Roberta, thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you very much, Roberta from Homer. We're talking about Arctic issues in the International Polar Year on Talk of Alaska today. And I suddenly have lost my monitor. Oh, there it is. It's back. I think I might have to kick my headphone plug. And we're joined now by David Hayes, the Deputy Secretary of the Interior by telephone in Washington. David, are you with us?
I'm with you, Steve. Great to be with you.
Great. Well, you know, you keep coming into Alaska, but I never find out until after you've left because you're here. You are so busy when you're here.
Well, it is a busy time when I drop into town, but we'll have to make sure you and I get together next time.
Yeah, that's great, and I'm very glad that you were willing to come on the show today and talk a little bit about this working group that you've got going in Washington, which, as I understand, had a meeting yesterday, and Fran Ulmer was an important part of it, so I thought I'd give you a chance to speak about. We already were speaking with Jay Gulledge at the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions and talking about how there was some movement in the Obama administration to try and pay more attention to the Arctic. And you seem to be kind of at the forefront of that.
Well, yes, I think so, Steve. The president has really prioritized the Arctic for the administration, and a couple of indications of that. First, on the international level, Secretary Hillary Clinton and Secretary Ken Salazar and I, along with Lisa Murkowski, went to the Arctic Council meeting in Denmark last year at this time, the first time ever a Secretary of State, much less a Secretary of the Interior, has participated in that eight-nation group that looks at Arctic issues. And then the other example of the president's interest in this was the executive order that he issued last July that set up this interagency working group on energy issues for Alaska, and I'm the chair of that group. We work with all of the federal agencies that have interest in Alaska and are working to coordinate both conventional and renewable energy development in the state.
And so, obviously, this is tied in with the situation the administration found itself in, where basically there's a big oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and at the same time there are very expensive leases held by Shell Oil in the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea, and suddenly the administration's on the hot seat about it, and you're the guy that has to walk the tightrope on this.
Well, they never said these jobs are going to be easy, Steve. but you know, it's to some extent it's a blessing in disguise that we had that horrible experience of going through that oil spill in the Gulf. It was all hands on deck for months, and that showed us that we need to be vigilant when it comes to ensuring that the oil and gas industry is ready for offshore drilling. And we've taken that approach to the Arctic, and in working with Shell that is interested, has applied for some exploratory drilling this summer, we've taken that cautious approach and have been working through the issues very deliberately with them. If oil drilling goes ahead, we want it to be the safest oil drilling ever done, given the special and fragile environment that we have with the Arctic.
Yeah, it's politically it's kind of difficult. Living in Alaska, we know that there's been offshore drilling in the Arctic literally for decades, and yet to hear the environmental groups say it, you know, that it's never been done before, and we want to stop them before they ever do it. But they have been doing it. This is just more having to do with federal lease tracts, water that's further out, and really also the Chukchi, which was drilled
right
in an exploratory fashion earlier, but now we're down to the point where they're getting closer to their deposits there and developing them, and we're also in the process of learning the science of what actually is there in the Chukchi, and it turns out that we're dealing with a very rich marine environment, which
right,
probably they didn't know that much about when they put them up for leases. And so what I understand it, this working group of yours is trying to do is to make sure that the information flows freely.
That's exactly right, Steve. What we found as we got our working group together and got decision makers across our government together as we looked at the Alaska issues we recognize how important the science is to help us make good decisions. And frankly, there's been a disconnect to some extent between the scientific community and the policymaking community. So Fran Ulmer, your previous lieutenant governor, who now heads up the Arctic Research Commission, and I have gotten together on this, and we've brought together the science community and the policymaker community and said, how can we make sure that the science that we're putting out there for Alaska and the Arctic in particular is answering questions that will help decision makers make good decisions. We're having a terrifically robust discussion with both communities. We're together more than we ever have been, and it's actually very exciting because everyone wants us, all of us, to make the right decisions, and an informed decision is going to be a better decision.
Deputy Secretary David Hayes is with us, and he's kind of the Obama administration's point man on this issue of energy in Alaska. And we have already an email question for you, Deputy Secretary Hayes, which is you've said that you'd like to implement some energy measures, renewable energy, conservation, et cetera, in rural Alaska as soon as possible. How has progress been on this front?
That's a great question. We have been focusing on renewable energy along with conventional energy, and we have developed four task groups in the federal government across the renewable energy spectrum. We've got a task force that's working on biomass. We've got task forces that are working on geothermal, hydro, solar, wind, and from the Native Alaskan perspective, remote villages, and we never before has the federal government sort of pooled across the departments what we've got going, and it's impressive. What we're actually looking at now is whether there are some models we can use to help replicate wind power in particular in some of these remote off-the-grid villages. And I'm going to be coming up to Anchorage actually later this month for some meetings along these lines. So it's very much in the front of our agenda, a renewable energy alongside the conventional energy that's obviously also taking a lot of our attention.
Well, I'm really excited about that. We've discussed that many times on this program, and Mira Kohler, who I'm sure you'll be dealing with when you come up here, is very very straightforward on this. It was very interesting how once AVAC got involved, because they have multiple sites, they were able to quickly find the model technology that could be replicated in other villages. So it's working that way.
Well, and we're excited about it. I mean, it just makes sense to try to come up with a model that can be replicated across villages. I mean, this can be extremely complicated, but it seems to us it doesn't have to be if we recognize that these are communities whose power needs are limited but significant for every individual in that village, where the status quo relying on expensive diesel, hard to get to diesel, is really not appropriate. We can do better, and that's what we're focused on.
So you got any other mileposts we might want to look towards for your working group in the near future? It seems that final decisions are due pretty quickly on the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea lease activity this year.
Yes, we're processing the applications for permits to drill that Shell has put in for both the Chukchi and the Beaufort to do exploratory drilling during the window of the summer season, and we're processing those. We'll be going making a decision on those in the coming weeks, and then I think more generally this collaboration that our working group has going with the science community is going to continue. The meeting we had yesterday included representatives of the governor's office, municipalities, NGOs like Pew and others, and we are very excited about the richness of this discussion. I'm not sure where that's going to lead, but we're committed to continuing to lash up the science and the policymakers here and take advantage of all the attention that's going into the Arctic and make sure that that it leads to better results in terms of decision making.
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for being on the program, and I'm really hoping that some Tuesday morning we can rope you in here to talk to Alaskans on Talk of Alaska for an hour.
I'd love to do that, Steve. We'll try to make that happen.
All right. Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you.
It's Talk of Alaska, and our issues are Arctic issues and the International Polar Year. As you can already tell, there's just a great deal of territory to cover. You start looking, and it gets bigger. And then you start looking, and it gets bigger yet, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Well, as we can see, the Arctic is forcing decisions. Things are changing in the Arctic, and those changes are particularly visible right here in our own state of Alaska. So we try and talk about it quite a bit on Talk of Alaska. And as you can hear, there's a great deal of interest and discussion going on in Washington, D.C., just in the past few days, really, on Arctic issues. And some things are starting to move. Meanwhile, the International Polar Year happened. And for someone who's interested in science, this is fascinating. The International Geophysical Year is essentially what created, that was in 1957. And it essentially created the whole scientific basis of scientific work in Alaska. It brought these people to Alaska as young people that then became professors and had all these great graduate students, and the heritage can still be seen of that scientific thrust involving scientists all around the world more than 50 years ago. So they decided they'll do an International Polar Year in 2007, and they did. And once again, the scientists went out and they made their observations and they came back. And it turns out the Arctic is so big, it's taken quite a while to get the pattern from all of this data that has been gathered. So I've asked for some expert help, and I really have a very qualified person to help me kind of look through what we know so far, and that is the Sidney Chapman Chair of Physical Sciences at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who also is a multiply award-winning scientist with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans in Canada. He joins us by telephone from Vancouver, Eddie Carmack. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Eddie.
Well, thank you very much for calling.
Yes, I'm so glad that you could join us on the program. You have an impressive overview, and you know, I said, well, we could talk about this science and that science and that science, and you said, well, here's some strong foci. And they are, every one of them. I mean, maybe you want to just go ahead and introduce those themes, because they're excellent.
Launch right into it, huh? Well, during the International Polar Year, which actually ran from 2007 till this last week, really, with the conclusion of the conference, I was engaged in a program called Canada Three Oceans, and that was really to make the point that northern North America has three oceans surrounding it. So we used science-capable icebreakers to encircle northern North America all the way from Vancouver Island in the Pacific through the Alaskan waters or over the top of Alaska into the Beaufort Sea and through the Northwest Passage and down the coast of Baffin Bay and Labrador all the way back to Halifax. Now, that's a pretty long section. It's about 12,000 kilometers. And when I wrote the proposal, it was stating back in 2006 that we were just going to do a baseline so we could gauge change in years to come, 2020, 2050, and on. What's so surprising from this was things are changing so fast that we more or less watched it taking place. So with that, what we're starting to see globally, and starting to, something that's starting to worry economists and policymakers, are these rapid changes that are affecting things we worry about, like food, water, and energy. And we're learning that how strongly these social ecological systems are linked, but also that these global systems are nonlinear, and changes are not smooth or predictable even, but instead they're abrupt, they're full of surprise, tipping points comes to mind. And in the Arctic, this nonlinear future that the entire planet has got to deal with has basically arrived. So there is this urgent need to understand the consequences of resource development and exploration before irreversible mistakes are made or we find ourselves into a situation that we had no awareness of.
Yeah, well, let me just back up a little bit on that, because the it seems like we saw what appears to be a phase change or something like that with the 2007 record withdrawal of sea ice. And it's, you know, it happened in the fall. It went further back than anybody had ever seen it before. And guess what? Every fall since then, it's the same thing. So we're up to 5 years of this now.
Yeah, that's a good example of a threshold. And it's not only the sea ice extent, it's the actual volume of ice in the Arctic Ocean and its age. When I started this work 40 years ago, I mean, we knew the Arctic ice was quite stable. It was very thick. But now it's a very rapidly moving medium that's thinning as it goes. And the point with the sea ice is, if you consider things being connected, this is sort of like the first domino in a series of events that start tipping one after another, and it's leading to different changes in the climate system, in the physical environment, in the biological environment, and we really don't know where it's going to end up. But it is true that we have a different ice regime today than we did a decade ago.
Yeah, and I have, on this program that we do once a week, I've had occasion to speak to several people who have done some Arctic exploration, ground truthing, I guess you could call it. And I think in both cases, ones that went across the Arctic, they ran into the very same thing that you said, that we thought we were getting baseline, but what we were doing was witnessing change that was taking place right in front of our eyes.
That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, one of our big efforts was to work in the waters north of Alaska in the Beaufort Gyre, or the deep ocean. And what we saw just in this, you know, past decade is that associated with the ice melting, the ocean surface became fresher, and that meant that that water floating at the top of the Arctic Ocean was lighter, and it was more difficult to get the nutrients from below into the surface layer. And this begins to affect the basic primary production of phytoplankton in the Arctic Ocean, and that's the base of the food web. So what we're looking at now is the possibility that the Arctic will become less productive out in the deep parts of the basin. But the next domino in the tipping point was that low salinity ice melt water has a less, it's a lower alkalinity, let's say, and it's so more susceptible to the increases in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that are leading globally to ocean acidification. So in a way, Alaska is quite interesting in this respect. I think Alaskans really need to be, not concerned, but to look at what's going on, because in a way we found out from this Canada 3 ocean transect that Alaska is sort of near the ground zero of major ocean changes, in that, you know, north of Alaska is one of the major places where the ice retreated. The waters around Alaska, for oceanographic reasons, are very susceptible to the acidification challenge. And the waters of the North Pacific are witnessing declining oxygen values. So all these things about ocean warming, acidification, and hypoxia are quite centered on the waters around Alaska.
Yeah, we're speaking with Eddie Carmack, and he's renowned ocean scientist and currently a professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. You obviously have to be familiar with the circumpolar flaw lead study.
Yes. And now, the circumpolar flaw lead study was it was the major Canadian contribution to the International Polar Year.
Right.
And that the an icebreaker was a science icebreaker was frozen into the waters north of the sort of the Mackenzie area or Amundsen Gulf, and had a very unique opportunity, let's say, to spend an entire year measuring what goes on in a season. So if you compare that approach, which was to stay basically in one general area and try to understand how the physics is working, how the chemistry is working, and the biology is working all through a season, gives you a picture that, you know, we just never have had before. That's very different from the Three Oceans transect, which was to, take a snapshot of conditions in the summer all the way around the northern North America. So the kind of the exciting stuff, I think, is going to come when we try to put these two things together and understand how the system is working.
Yeah. Well, one thing the lead study seemed to find is open water in the winter.
Oh, yes, and smushy ice.
Yeah.
I hope you can get David Barber on the program to go over the multitude of things that were found and during the circumpolar flaw lead experiment. I mean, they were able to make headway through ice that ice charts were telling them it should be hard and very difficult for the icebreaker. This again comes back to this notion of surprise. I think one of the things we found out in the International Polar Year, I hope this doesn't sound like a scientific cliche, but we learned a great deal about this hidden world, but we learned about how much further we need to go to really understand the dynamics and what it's going to be. One thing I might add to that, you mentioned, let me just back up. You mentioned the International
Geophysical
Year, and I just wanted to point out that Sidney Chapman was one of the key drivers of making that a reality. And the former Sidney Chapman chair was Norbert Unterstein, who passed away just recently. And he was actually spent a year on an ice floe drifting around in the Arctic Ocean back in those days. as part of the International Geophysical Year. So I feel a really strong connection to this.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal heritage by Alaska. It really
yes.
is.
So now, one thing I might add to this rapid change is that we're documenting, at least in the project that I was involved with, changes that are going on, let's say, out there in the Arctic Ocean, on ships, often far from land. And the pressing need now is to draw that information in to examine what it means to the coastal zone or to the people who are living in coastal communities. And we could look at that in two ways. One is that that coastal communities will be impacted by change in ways that we don't know, and these ideas of flip and surprise and new regime shifts are very much in the question zone. But at the same time, the people living in the coastal communities have this this incredible knowledge and understanding of their place and the area they live, and even slight changes that a scientist with delicate instruments might miss, someone living in these communities would be able to note. So I think, at least my next hope to see as a follow-up to the IPY is to see this unification or getting together of people in the coastal communities to become something of like an early warning system to these nonlinear changes that we are starting to worry about.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm kind of watching the coming together in new ways of the policy side and the scientific side, but also the scientific side with the I don't know, you could call it like the ethnosphere, you know, like how people are related to the land that they live on, and that there's value in that type of knowledge because they're really talking about the same thing. It's fascinating, Eddie Carmack. I'm going to start with the calls here, and I know that you're quite capable of sitting in a meeting and watching what's going on, and you're welcome to stay with us or leave whichever way you like, but I want to get these callers on and see what they have to say.
Okay, well, it's been a pleasure talking, and thank you very much.
All right, do you want to hang on, or are you going to leave us now?
Well, I can hold tight for about 5 minutes.
All right, well, just
how would that be?
Hang in there, and we'll say goodbye to you in 5 minutes as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And so on Talk of Alaska, we open the book of the Arctic once again. And once again, we find all these surprises. We've got Eddie Carmack with us. And by phone, we have Sue joins the program from Nome. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Sue.
Oh, thank you very much, Steve. And thank you, Eddie, for your discussion. And it, very interesting that right at the end, you started to lead into the topic that I was calling about, that I live in Nome. I've very familiar with the Bering Straits region and the villages and the lifestyle in our villages here. And I'm deeply concerned, not just with all of the climate change and how it's affecting the ice and other movements, but with the increase in shipping and exploration and development in the Arctic, whether it's the Northwest Passage or the Northeast Passage. Everything funnels through the Bering Straits, which is just 59 miles from mainland to mainland with two islands in the middle. And I'm deeply concerned regarding the subsistence practices that are very much alive and vibrant in our coastal communities and how all of this onslaught of traffic through this very narrow bottleneck through which pass all of the bowhead whales, the gray whales, the walruses, the ice seals, throughout the summer season. There's a major push north in the spring and a major push north in the fall, but there's also continued movements throughout the summer. And I'm not hearing enough about the impact on contemporary subsistence practices and what all of this bottleneck effect in the Bering Straits is going to have on villages where subsistence is a nutritional issue, it's an economic issue, it's a cultural issue, it's a social issue. It's the glue that binds our villages together and keeps people healthy and communities whole. And I just wanted to hear that piece brought into this discussion.
Well, you just did, Sue.
Yeah.
Well, how do we engage these?
I couldn't agree.
Elevate this issue into the larger discussion taking place nationally and internationally?
I think Deputy Secretary Hayes would have loved to hear what you had to say, and would have had a political answer. But the fact of the matter is, it's just going to take persistence. The idea that here we've got an oceanographer, right? And we're trying to get to the food chain, and the food chain's going to take us to the subsistence resources. And that's a long way. That's a long way. So it takes a lot of persistence to say, no, you really have to pay attention to subsistence. You know, there's people living here. They're living on this coast.
Well, yeah. I think we have to help empower those voices and those concerns in these discussions as we look at the environment on a larger basis and everything else that's coming. I just want to raise the alarm, I guess, and say that there's another piece here that needs greater consideration, and I guess we will continue to try to elevate the concern of what's potentially coming and the significance of the impact that it's going to have on this region.
All right, Sue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. It is right now the Coast Guard's trying to figure out, and probably the Russians are going to get involved in a constructive way, is keeping a better eye on and maybe even starting to impose some regulatory regime on the traffic through the Bering Strait. Eddie Carmack, this seems almost like it's got to come at some point.
Well, the traffic issue is incredibly complex, but Sue's absolutely right. I think job one is making sure that we don't disturb or destroy the systems that exist, and if anything, empower the people living in coastal communities even more. Now, I did mention this notion of trying to form, let's just call it a necklace or a network of people living around northern North America, right from Vancouver Island through around Alaska, through the Northwest Passage and down the other coast, to measure the same properties in their coastal communities that we're finding that are changing when we go through on icebreakers or larger ships. I think the most important part of this is not the data that comes out of it, but the dialogue that will develop as people in different coastal communities compare their own results. And they become now a voice in change and the way that the world is rearranging itself. And another point about traffic is we are always talking about in the Arctic change game, or let's just say up in the Canadian Arctic or Northwest Passage, always talking about big ships coming in from the outside, tankers or tourist ships or whatever. What about the need now for building, if there's going to be more and more ice-free water, the coastal communities can benefit from their own marine capacity being developed. Let's see more small vessels in the Arctic that are carrying out the needs of people who live in the north. So this would be an example of you might call it adaptive or transformative, but it would give more capacity to people in the communities to travel, to develop their economics, to have their subsistence needs met.
All right, Eddie Carmack, I want to thank you so much for being with us on Talk of Alaska.
Well, thank you very much again.
All right, Charlie joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Charlie.
Good morning, Steve. Good program. Appreciate it. I just get back to this one thing, you know. Since in 89, I stood down here on the beach and watched the oil come ashore. The oil industry does not know how to pick oil up out of cold water, cold and icy water, not at all. Not a warm Gulf water down in the Gulf of Mexico. And since all the sea life seem to spend a part of their early age in the top few inches of the water column, even just small spills have an effect on your sea life and on your ultimate subsistence and everything else. How can we be out there poisoning this stuff for where we don't have to? There's enough places on land to drill for oil to not have to be out there until we can do it in such a manner that we don't spill anything. Triple pipe, triple layered pipe, something. I've been in oil business all my life, 76 years, and I don't think we ought to do it until we can pick the oil up. And I'll remind everybody what Lieutenant Commander Blaisdell told me in Homer in 1989 when the oil kind of disappeared over in the Prince William Sound and they didn't know where it was. And I was goading them into trying to figure out a way to test to find out where that oil was going. This Lieutenant Commander of the Coast Guard, Lieutenant Commander Blaisdell of the Coast Guard, he told me, Charlie, it's gone. And I said, gone where? He says, we don't care. As long as it's gone, it's gone. And then a week later, it pops up over here on my beach. So,
yeah.
I just want to remind everybody, we can't do that until we can pick oil up, and hopefully the powers that be will see that.
It seems that, yeah, I think with the industry, you would know because you've worked in it, what tends to happen is slippage, regulatory slippage, as the years go by. I mean, we sure saw that with Alyeska. You know, if the Exxon Valdez had happened, right after they got that system going, they'd been able to do some containment. It probably still would have been too big a spill, but they would have at least had, some barge that would be capable of taking the oil off of the water and so forth. And as it was, they had nothing. They didn't have booms, they had nothing.
So they immediately started out misrepresenting how much oil had spilled. Finley Abbott down here has got the figures that shows.
Yeah, I know.
7.5 million.
So. Right. Yeah, I know. I know Finley's right too. He sold me on it.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Most of the other people that know what's going on. Yeah.
I come from the independent end of the oil business, Steve. My dad was a wildcatter, and my family were investors in the oil fields back in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
But anyway, I got a lot of good information from that.
All right, Charlie. Well, we're out of time this time around.
Thank you. Au revoir.
All right. Au revoir. And thank you for being with us. It's Talk of Alaska. I want to thank all the people who helped bring this program together because it's a pretty rough one this time around. Thank you very much. Also, Dave Waldron, Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.